Thanks, Minet, for the nice introduction. It's always a pleasure talking to this audience. And there's also the nice coincidence with the workshop that Katie has been organizing this week, where we touched upon some of the similar topics. So today I'll be showing you two examples of interesting light boson dynamics in the early universe and also in the late universe, and how we can use them to look for this new physics. Okay, so I'm a particle physicist, and I'm interested in physics beyond standard model. And we know they exist from, this pie chart, where we see that the matter, which makes up of you and me, is only 5% of the total energy budget in the universe today, whereas 27% is dark matter. Well, 68% is dark energy. So this evidence, this gravitational evidence, come from a variety of measurements. The most important one is the CMB, through the temperature fluctuations and their correlation functions. We managed to weigh basically all the energy components in the universe. The evidence for dark matter also exists in galaxies. The first evidence come from the galaxy rotation curves, which also tells us that these things are in our galaxy. And also, like the most concrete evidence for dark matter as a completely different species come from the Birch cluster, where we know the dark matter interact very weakly with us and also with itself. Okay, so we know dark matter exists, but where do we start looking for them? So this is all the energy scale, which we have some experience with in the universe, starting from the Hubble scale today at the left, 10^-33 eV, all the way to the Planck scale, which is 6 orders of magnitude larger. So the question, so given the vast parameter space, we should start asking ourselves some questions to determine where we should start. So the first question is, so is this model already excluded? So we have made some progress on the left-hand side, especially some new results coming from Neil Dallaro in the audience, where from the study of ultra-faint to dwarf galaxies and the stellar dynamics inside, the lower limit has moved to 3×10^-19. Though EV, though this range of parameter space is still 40 order magnitude. So we can continue to ask ourselves questions. The second question that is of great importance is, how are these particles produced in the early universe? So this generally separates in, the dark matter candidates that we're most interested in into two categories. The first one are dark matter which are produced thermally through either the thermal freeze-out or thermal freeze-in. So the most prominent of these examples is the WIMP, the weakly interacting massive particle, which is around a TeV mass. So there is also a second type of production coming from gravitational production, which generally produce particles that are very light, and light bosons especially. So these include axions and dark photons. Okay, so axions which are very light, and the dark photons around the EV mass. So then we can continue to ask ourselves questions. So the third question that is also important is, are these targets theoretically well motivated? So since I'll be mostly talking about these light bosons, I'll provide some motivations for these light bosons. So of course, the most prominent of these kind of light boson dark matter or light boson states beyond standard model is the QCD axion, which was initially proposed to solve the Swan CP problem, which concerns the electrodipole moment of the neutron, whereas the theoretical expectation tells me that this electrodipole moment of the neutron should be somewhere around Fermi times order one CP violating angle theta. The experimental measurement tells me that this quantity is actually at least 10 order magnitude smaller, which tells me that the strong CP angle theta is smaller than 10^-10. Though a similar CP violating effect in the standard model in the weak sector comes with a CKM angle, which is order one. So the QCD axion was proposed to solve this tension between the theoretical expectation and the experimental measurement. And the idea is to promote this theta angle to a field. And through the early universe dynamics, this theta angle dynamical relaxed to zero through cosmic evolution. So later on, people realized that the QCD axion comes with cousins in string theory coming from string compactation and the gauge field living in the extra dimensions. So these leaves IR remnants of these compactations coming in the form of light bosons existing in what is known as the string X-verse and the photoverse. So these particles can be separated into three general categories. There are the pseudoscalars, which are the axions, for which the QCD axion is the most prominent one. And then there are gauge vector fields, or gauge fields, which are like dark photons. And then there are also scalars, which are known as moduli and dilatons. So the first two can be naturally light, protected by shift symmetry and gauge approximate shift symmetry and approximate gauge symmetry, while the last one can be light, potentially in connection to the anisotropic resolution of cosmological constant problems. But we will only be talking about the first two in this talk. So we are interested in the QCD axion, or the axions as a dark matter candidate. We are also interested in the dark photon as a dark matter candidate in a slightly different mass range, but also as a mediator of the interaction between us and potentially with a rich dark sector. So in the workshop, we heard a lot about different dark matter scenarios, dissipative dark matter, for example, where the dark photon is clearly playing a very crucial role. And the understanding is just like the standard model photon is playing the most important role for almost all the observations that we have in the universe, the dark photon might be playing a similar role in the dark sector. So with all of these motivations, we can think about how we can search for these states. And in the next two slides, I will be showing you the parameter space for the axions and dark photons. So first, the parameter space for the axion. On the left-hand side, we have a plot for the axion-photon coupling, the interaction between axion and E dot B of the electromagnetism. Well, on the right-hand side, we have the axion-gluon coupling, which couples axion to the GG dual of SU3 color. So there has been a lot of effort to look into this parameter space, including some of my recent work. And the one in red is the work that I will mention a little bit in this talk.
So on the right, so the idea is that you can wait from the QCD axion line by
some
addition to the mass.
By some other addition to the mass. So it just I was about to say. So on the left hand side, there is an important theoretical target, which is the QCD axion band, which is this yellow band here. While on the right hand side, we should really be trying to get to the QCD axion line, and whereas like the parameter space above it is much less motivated compared to the left-hand side. So we have a lot of experimental searches, which excludes a lot of the parameter space, which include the astrophysics constraints in green, the lab constraints in red, and also the cosmological constraint in blue. So this is for the axion. Similarly, we can look at the dark photon. So since I will be using the dark photon as the main example to explain the dynamics and the searches that we'll be talking about, let me say a little bit more about the Lagrangian. So the dark photon is just like our photon. It has the normal kinetic term of a U1 gauge boson. And then it has a mass from potentially a Higgs mechanism. And the mass is important if we want to consider it as a dark matter, because that will need to be non-relativistic. So it couples to us through this parameter epsilon, which is the kinetic mixing parameter, which basically quantifies how weakly this particle is coupled to the electrons compared to the standard model photon. So epsilon equal to 1 would mean that this particle couples the same strength with the electrons as the standard model photon. And generally, we want to be searching for the dark photon in parameter space where the kinetic mixing parameter is much less than 1. So in all of these plots, I'm showing you the interaction strength as a function of the particle mass. The two plots have different assumptions. The one on the left assumed just that this particle exists in the Lagrangian. While on the right-hand side, we have this particle existing as dark matter, which is the assumption. And you see that we have designed a lot of these experiments to look for this dark photon as dark matter, which has all these projections here. So, okay, so that's the axion and dark photon. And most of these constraints and the probes that we proposed are based on this crucial change of perspective, where we instead of thinking about these particles as individual particles which goes around, where we are thinking about these very light particles, they behave more like waves than particles. And you can see that basically if you have a particle that is very light, the component wavelength is very long, and also the Boyle wavelength. And if you have the same density, then these wave functions will be overlapping each other. And then like you should really be thinking about these light bosons as classical waves in the weak field limit, and they are just oscillating up and down like around us. Okay, so this is one of the crucial understandings which leads us to design all of these searches. The second one, which actually eventually lead us to deviate from this, the first understanding, is the fact that these light bosons are easily affected by medium effect, by their environment. And we know this for the gauge light boson that exists in the standard model of the photon, right? So this is sunlight shining on PI, which unfortunately is not happening today. But for describing this sunlight, you really just describe it as a massless wave, which is propagating, right? But of course, in different systems, light takes on different phases. So for example, in the case of the plasma, it shows up as plasma oscillations. The mode is effectively gapped by the plasma frequency of the photon. Well, on the bottom, you can have superconductors, and where the U1 is Higgs, and which give rise for example, the Meissner effect. So similar to the photon, you will see that these light bosons can also be affected by their respective medium effect. So in this talk, I will be showing you two examples, the first one, I will be telling you how we can take advantage of these in-medium effects, actually mostly for the photon in this case, to find and create a correct medium to improve our searches for this light photon. And in the second part of the talk, I will be showing you how this in-medium effect can lead to striking phenomena, which might shape the parameter space that we actually probe. And as you will see, it will produce some striking new signatures in an event called the string pulse nova. So example number one. So in this part, I will be telling you how we can use the existing cosmological measurement to design new searches to be very sensitive to these light bosons. So in all kinds of searches for these light dark bosons, including the dark photon and also the axion, the situation we always try to create is shown in this doodle here, where we are trying to create a system where I can resonate convert the standard model photon into the dark photon or vice versa. Okay, so in the lab, we are usually trying to do it to the left. And the way we do it is by carefully choosing boundary conditions or systems such that within it we can have photon modes which has dispersion relation that matches that of the dark matter particle. So at least like in the small wavelength limit. Okay. So for example, in ADMX, we realized this by using cavity modes. Well, in the other experiments, we can use photonic crystals to create like band structures of photon inside these crystals, and which some of which will be matched with the dispersion relation of the dark photon. So in the cosmos, certainly I'm not sending someone to 0 equal to 1 to do experiment. So I cannot create this environment. right? But luckily, the environment is created for me, and all I need to do is trying to identify the right systems or the right environment where this resonant conversion happens, okay? The nice thing about our Cosmos is it contains basically ionized electrons everywhere, which produce a plasma frequency for the photon, which is proportional to the ionization fraction XE, the baryon density, baryon number density over the mass of the electron. Okay, so if we can identify regions where this resonant condition is automatically satisfied, and then maybe we can use these regions to do a search. So even more luckily, cosmology provides us with two natural scanners, which scans this electron density or the plasma frequency. The first one comes in the form of cosmic expansion, right? So the universe starts from a hot, dense state early on. And as the universe expands, it dilutes, which means that the plasma frequency goes down. It goes through the two stages of recombination and the reionization, where here the ionization fraction drops by 4-order magnitude, and here it goes back to 1. So throughout the early universe evolution, this density continues to dilute, and the plasma frequency basically scans different values during this evolution. So no matter where I put my dark photon mass in this plot, right, all the way from somewhere like 10 minus 14 eV all the way to 10 minus 8 eV, there's some period in the early universe where this conversion is happening automatically. So this is the first scanner. The second scanner happens at late universe. It comes in the form of structures that has formed, right? So here, what you are seeing is the density distribution or the plasma frequency as a function of the radius in a virilized halo. So the blue line is the famous NFW profile for the dark matter inside halo, while the orange line shows you the corresponding density profile inside a halo of electrons. So no matter what's your dark photon mass, all over this two-order magnitude in plasma frequency, you can always find a location in the halo where this conversion happens automatically. Okay. So since this is going to be the object that we'll be using to design an estimator or design observable, I'll be spending a little bit more time on what is actually happening here. So imagine you have a photon which has gone through a galaxy. As you get closer and closer to the center, you see a density which increases and an environment where the plasma frequency grows towards the center. And at some point, the plasma frequency is matched to the dark photon mass. The resonant conversion happens at this location here. You continue to go until you hit the resonance again before you leave the system. Okay. So in this process, the photon gets converted into the dark photon twice, and all of these points where the conversion is happening basically form this shell around any galaxy. Okay, so at this location, some photon gets converted into a dark photon, and the conversion rate can be computed with a Landau-Zener transition. The details of which I won't go into, but just point to you some important parameter dependencies. So the conversion probability scales as the kinetic mixing parameter epsilon squared. You know that has to be the case, because if there's no interaction, of course, there's no effect. It has two important dependencies. The first dependence is the dependence on the frequency of the photon. So there is a 1 over omega dependence on the photon frequency. I just want to emphasize, though we are talking about resonance effect, we are not producing a line. Instead, we are removing a photon at all frequency in the black body spectrum. I'm just removing more photon at low frequencies compared to higher frequencies, okay, from the black body spectrum.
Are there any situations where you don't can have a geometric transition on 1000. Would be like a total loss of.
Yeah. So like this is much more efficient if the resonant condition can be satisfied, and it has more anisotropies. And you will see like the anisotropies will be important when we talk about looking for this effect.
So in other language, this is a jump from one flash to another.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah. Are there any situations where it can stay in the same way? Like an NSW?
Yeah, I think like if you are the plasma frequency is changing like slowly, compared to this wavelength of these oscillations, I think like this formula is always valid and you always transition as long as you do not have too many other anisotropies on the line. But we can talk more about this later. Yeah. So so that's the first part. This is the frequency dependence. The second dependence that is important is in this blue box, but it's basically already shown like in this picture here, which is the fact that this conversion depends on where you are in the halo. And as a result, it has some position dependence. So in the CMD language, since we are looking from here far away at the 2D surface, this amounts to frequency and angular direction dependent loss of photon, which we model as an optical depth parameter. Okay, so that's what a halo does to one photon. So now let's send the CMB through this halo. Okay, so the CMB, of course, contains a multiple component of 2.7 Kelvin and some small anisotropy on top. So if the effect we are thinking about does something to the monopole, then that will be the main effect. So let's first ask a question like, what happens when I send the monopole through the galaxy? Does it do anything? Okay, so that's basically a picture here. And of course, we know some photon gets converted into the dark photon, so some photon gets lost, which we put here as a cold spot. We are interested in like how these what it does when this photon goes through the last shell structure. Of course, it contains a lot of galaxies of different size, and they all cast different size cold spots, right? And so it gives me a map like that, and we call this map the dark greening map. Remember, in the unit where the CMB is a constant as a function of frequency, this new map we create has a position and frequency dependence. Okay, so putting things back together, if we start with the CMB with anisotropies, it goes through this galaxy or the last shell structure. Afterwards, we have the CMB temperature map with the primary and also the secondary anisotropies coming from all kinds of standard model effects, which we call TCMB. Well, on the other hand, we also created this new map, which we call the dark screening map. So now two questions remain. The first question is, how do I separate these two maps, right? So that I can actually use this one. And the second question is how do you actually use this map? So I will talk about the second question first, right? So the first thing you can do when you have a map, of course, you can take the angular average, right? So which is basically like the average over all angles, and then since you are removing some photon, this means like the whole thing gets a little bit colder. And since we are removing photon in a frequency-dependent manner, this changes the CMB spectrum that you see, which is basically a spectral distortion. So this effect has been considered by people in the past, in, for example, these two papers, where they use some data in the past to constrain the parameter space of the dark photon. And I'm going to show you these constraints later. Okay. So, but like we have done all of this hard work to obtain some maps. Doing average is certainly not the smartest thing to do. So what can we do now? Well, like all cosmological measurements, we can construct correlation functions. We can, for example, correlate the map with itself, right? So this is basically the autocorrelation. which has depends on these parameters in this way. So it depends on the CMB monomer temperature as well as the two-point correlation of this conversion probability. Okay, so this is much better. But as you can see, we are using this dark screening map twice, right? Each one comes with the conversion probability, which scales at epsilon squared. So the whole thing scales at epsilon to the 4. And if you are ever in the business of looking for small effects, scaling with epsilon to the 4 is not a place to start, right? So how can we do better? Well, we can do cross-correlation. So of course, the map that we generate is correlated with the galaxies which cast all these cold spots. So we can construct a correlation function between the dark screening map with the galaxy that cast these cold spots. Here, the dark screening map only comes up once, so it's scale as epsilon squared, and instead of epsilon to the 4. So we call this correlation function generally a BSM cross-standard model type operator. So the BSM refers to the Beyond Standard Model effect, which created this map, right? So in here, like it's the log photon, and the map comes from the CMB. Well, the standard model refers to the standard model of cosmology, which comes from all the objects that it contains, which can be tracers, and it can be the environment where this conversion is happening. Okay, so so these operators are very sensitive to all kinds of new physics that we can extract from cosmological data.
Do you need two frequencies at least?
Yes, we are getting there, okay? So that's the question of map separation, right? So you might think like this is actually what we observe, like this is a plot you see like from the Planck. But what you actually observe is all of these. So this contains the CMB map coming from the lowest frequency, like 30 gigahertz to 857 gigahertz. These are all like maps coming from Planck, right? So in this plots, of course, you have the primary CMB, but you can also have also like all kinds of foregrounds, which have their own different frequency dependence. And the idea to go from this to this plot on top is to weigh these maps in a way that you are most sensitive to some frequency dependence, which has the black body shape. So similarly, we can use the same idea to extract the information about this map, which has a frequency dependence that is 1 over omega compared to the black body shape of the primary CMB. Right? So, so this removal of photon is most important at the lower frequencies and much less important at higher frequencies. So we can weigh these maps in a different way, such that I'm most sensitive to this dark screening map. So that's how we extract the dark screening map, and then we use them. And now let me show you some projections. So this is the parameter space of the dark photon. I have the kinematics in parameter epsilon in the y-axis and the mass of the dark photon in the x-axis. So the shaded region is excluded by prior analysis of spectral distortion coming from Kolbe-Fares measurement. So with Planck data, data which is already available today, we can use the autocorrelation function and the cross-correlation function that we just talked about to probe this regional parameter space, which is two order of magnitude deeper than what was done before. So analysis is ongoing with Planck's data with many people in the audience. Hopefully we'll get that out soon. And then you can also show projections for some a future CMB survey, the CMBS4, which allows you to get to another order of magnitude in parameter space. Okay? So we've done a little bit more. We've constructed some other correlation functions with which we can break degeneracies if ever we see a positive signal. Okay? So these new estimators, which I haven't got time to talk about very much, but I'll have me to tell you more about them later, will allow us to break the degeneracy between the astrophysics and the mass of the dark photon and the epsilon parameter, so that when we have a measurement, we'll be able to pin down which point in this parameter space leads to the effect that we are looking at.
So So the right-hand side, the tuples is given by what when the structures come.
So the right-hand side part come from basically we are only using the circumgalactic medium, and inside galaxies today, the highest density you have around that point is roughly like corresponding to a plasma frequency of 10 minus 11 eV. The lower part come from basically the outermost edge of these halos. So there's mostly the contribution of here comes from a redshift of I think like 100 to like a few hundred. Yeah. So we can like generalize this method with different tracers to cover basically all of this parameter space better than spectral distortion. But yeah, I won't talk about the details. So so the same method can be applied to the axions. There are much more complications in the case of the axions. But as you can see, similarly, we can use CMB measurements to probe new parameter space beyond what we concretely excluded. OK? Yeah.
Like, is it obvious why the frost isn't much better than the oil?
The improvement is mostly in the L scaling. I think like the improvement is the maximum L you can be sensitive to the half power, like between these two searches. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the L max for the cross, I would imagine, would be just as good as the L max for the auto.
Yeah, so like this difference of a factor of 10 is basically like this L scaling.
Right. I thought you were saying that the cost goes like epsilon squared, the order goes like epsilon before, so therefore I would think that the cost would be much more sensitive, but you're only showing the factor.
When you do the Fisher forecast, right, like in the end, like it goes as basically the effect you have over the, it's always like epsilon, always comes with the same number of t and over the noise. It's just like a factor in front, which depends on L, which is different. Yeah, I can show you the formula, but like, it's roughly the, yeah. Okay.
So is the limitation here, the things like point sources in the galaxies, like the cross, or what?
So this so far, like in this part, there's no foreground component included. With the analysis, we include them. Yes, there are foreground contaminations. Because of the frequency dependence, it's mostly like a radio sources.
Yeah.
Yeah. OK. Right, so I was saying something about axions. But in general, the lesson we learned from this example is that we can use different backlight and study how these backlight go through the structures we know, like in the Stern model of cosmology. And due to the effects of new physics, these backlights might be affected in very different ways, with which we can construct estimators to look for these new effects by cross-correlating with the Stern model structures, which leads to this new signals that we're looking for. And we consider like CMB, but we can consider different backlight. We can consider different dark sector scenarios or dark matter scenarios, and we can use different tracers to do this measurement. So a lot of ongoing work with amazing collaborators. Many of you are in the audience. So that's example number one, where we see how we can take advantage of the immediate effect. So in the second part, I will show you how some of the immediate effect actually changes the parameter space we are looking into. So that comes with the phrase of a string Bose-Nova, where you are going to see some dramatic effect. Okay. So the question that we wanted to understand, okay. So as I talked to you about earlier, we are generally thinking of this dark matter wave as a classical wave in the weak field limit. Okay. So this assumption is quite good today, But if you tracked into the early universe and you track some other astrophysical objects, this assumption is a little less well motivated. So to give you the sense, let me just show you some numbers. So if we think about the dark photon, which has a mass of 10 minus 5, and we track back to the time in the early universe where we know dark matter definitely exists, of temperature of roughly a keV, of the standard model part, which is roughly a keV, then the occupation number, which is defined as basically the energy density over the mass to the fourth power, or the number density times the Compton wavelength cubed, is roughly 10 to the 29. Okay, so just this is a gigantic number. In the early universe, if we track even back to the point where like these particles are produced, for example, in inflation production, then this number can get all the way to 10 to the 54. Okay, and in some late universe dynamics, in the case of this black hole supereminence cloud, which is basically a super instability which grows around the spinning black holes, if we have a particle with mass that are comparable to the size of the black hole, then we can grow a supereminence cloud in which this quantity, this number can be as large as 10 to the 76. All of these numbers are not small. So the question is there something dramatic happens when we are enter like in the regime where the field is actually not ever weak? So I'm going to show you a video where you will see like what happens. So this is a video of a supereminence cloud which grows around a spinning black hole. So you are seeing a vector supereminence cloud, and the dark photon is growing. The color is increasing a little bit, meaning the amplitude of the field grows until it reaches some critical value where a string, which is the green line, emerges. So the green line is going to expand, and the field gets actually absorbed into the string until the string tension pulls it back in and get up back onto the black hole. So afterwards, as you see here, the supereminence cloud is totally gone. Okay. So what is happening? Well, let me first tell you what we are simulating. So what we are simulating here is the Abelian-Higgs model around a spinning black hole. So the Abelian-Higgs model has the following action. It has the kinetic term for the photon, U1 gauge boson. And it has a Higgs with a charge under this U1 gauge boson. The Higgs gets a Mexican potential and gets a VF, which Higgs the U1. So that both the dark photon and also the Higgs gets a mass. So so this is basically also the Landau-Ginzburg action, if you are coming from more condensed matter side. And the Stuckober limit is the limit we are interested in, where the Higgs mass is much heavier than the dark photon mass, which amounts to the parameter choice of this quartic coupling being much, much bigger than gauge coupling. So generally, we think like in this limit, we have a very, very heavy Higgs, right, and a very light dark photon. And for a large range of parameter space, we can be working with this low energy action, which contains basically a massive dark photon, okay, without worrying about the Higgs. And as long as the field strength is not large enough such that Schrödinger power production becomes important. So this is actually not true, and you already see it is not true, like in the simulation. So in the next few slides, I will be walking you through like what has happened. So I will be answering three questions. The first question is, what is this vortex that has formed? What is the string has formed? And then the second question is, what is the dynamics which leads to the string formation? And then lastly, like what does it do after the string has formed? So here, the first question, what is this vortex? So the vortex is the topological defect, or if you prefer to call it a string, it's the same thing, which was first discovered by, and the solution was first discovered by Abakusov in 1957 when he was studying type 2 superconductors. So what you are seeing here is a vortex, the cross-section view of a vortex, where around this point, singular point, the scalar field has an angle which goes around by a 4 2 pi. And the gauge field, if you take a line integral of the gauge potential around this vortex, you will find that the magnetic flux, which is going through, striding through this vortex, is equal to a unit magnetic flux phi naught. Okay, so this is the angular direction. In the radial direction, what is happening is that the phi field is equal to v far away, and as it goes to towards the center of the vortex, the phi goes to zero. This is basically the topological defect, and over a length range of roughly like 1/1 mass of the scalar field, well, the magnetic field goes logarithmically towards the center in a range that is set by the mass of the photon, or in the case of a superconductor, or the mass of the dark photon. Okay, so in the plot on the left, you see that this vortex is actually formed. So this is a view of the equator of an equator slice of the region around the black hole. So here you see a point where going around this point, the angle goes from minus pi to pi, right? So this is a vortex. The vortex go around and come back here and form a circle. Okay? So this is a view of a slice around the longitude. And you see like this black line, which basically gives you the regions where the scalar field is equal to zero, which is the location of the vortex. OK, we see a vortex loop has formed. So what is the dynamics which leads to this vortex formation? Right? So I'm going to show you this dynamics in a few plots, which like this, and click through them. Okay, so what you see here on the x-axis is basically like a position space, and the y-axis is both the phi field in blue and the magnetic field strength in red. The y-axis has arbitrary units, so that I can put both of them on the same plot. So the phi is equal to the value there. And now if I have a tiny magnetic field perturbation in the center, what happens is that the phi field wants to respond to it because this quantity becomes a little bigger here. So the blue line has a dent in the same location. And you know that the photon mass is equal to g, the gauge coupling times the phi value. So what happens now is that this is also a profile for the photon mass. The photon is the lightest than the center. So through Meissen effect, you know that the magnetic field wants the clustering region where the photon mass is the smallest. So the B field continues to go in this location, and the phi continues to drop until a vortex has formed. And when the phi goes to zero, and there's nowhere to go, so this is basically the formation of this topological defect. And this instability was first discovered by Galileo 10 years after the realization of the existence of these vortices. Okay, so also, he realized that such a phase transition becomes a superheated phase transition above critical field strength of B field, and which also becomes like f mu nu, the amplitude of f mu nu in the case we study, which is basically in this formula. Okay, so above this superheating field strength, the phase transition becomes second order, and this is a classical instability, and basically like the vortices will be forming everywhere in your growing gauge field, like wherever it can. Okay. So that's how the vortex formed. Now, what does it do afterwards? Okay. So what leads to this vortex expanding, right? The circle expanding and the removal of the gauge field. So to do that, I will show you go through this picture here, step by step again. So here, like you are seeing a vortex, which is pointing through the board. Okay. So the magnetic field direction is coming out. And going around the vortex, the A vector has this form. You can check that the line integral around the vortex integrate to a unit magnetic flux. Okay, so I have this vortex. Now I'm moving it. I'm moving it to the right with a small velocity. So with this velocity, this vortex gets a field around, electric field around it. This is the it's equal to basically the time derivative in the lab frame, or like if you go to the frame of the vortex, this is what it becomes. You can do this computation, or let me do it for you. So this is basically the orange line shows you the electric field around this vortex, which has formed, and this is electric field of a dipole. Especially, it is a two-dimensional dipole, which is pointing downwards, with a dipole moment per unit length, which is proportional to the velocity of the vortex going to the right. So one thing I want to emphasize is that the dipole moment goes 1 over the coupling strength, which means that unlike other objects, when you take the Zugerberg limit, when you take this gauge coupling to 0, these objects do not decouple. They actually get more and more strongly coupled, since they are magnetic in nature, right? Just like a magnetic monopole. Okay. So now let me put this vortex in a background electric field. Let's say it is pointing down. The electric dipole wants to increase such that the electric dipole energy becomes more and more negative, which means that this object is continuously getting accelerated to the right. Okay. So this is very much like the Hall effect, where I put the electric field pointing in one direction, and the object gets accelerated in the perpendicular direction. Okay, so this is the effect. Basically, takes all the field energy, which is still stored in the background field, and puts them all into the vortex, making it getting bigger, as you see in the video. Okay. So of course, like to actually simulate this, you need to do it actually with a string that is charged under a one-form gauge field, but like this picture, I think it shows you how this actually works with pure electromagnetism. Okay, so this is also happening. This is happening no matter how you are producing this background gauge field to start with. So earlier I showed you the case of the supraneous cloud, right? But similarly, in the early universe, when this gauge field strength, or like this occupation number, becomes very, very large, then the same vortex dynamics, forming dynamics will happen, which produce like a huge amount of vortex in the simulation box here. Okay, so after they form, which is happening at t equal to 0, what you see is that in also the early universe case, these strings form and remove, basically like absorb all the energy into them, while the energy density, which was initially stored in the background gauge field, decreases until it saturates to some much smaller value. Okay, so such a dynamics has consequences. So if you have this vortex formation in the early universe, and if you are producing like this dark U1s or any dark compact gauge group in the early universe and trying to make like a dark matter, then the vortex form in all of this pink shaded parameter space. Okay, so which you see covers basically all of the parameter space that we're trying to get with lab experiments. So if you ask like when does this vortex formation matter, if the vortex formation matter, if we just want to have dark matter at the time of, we know dark matter exists from CMB measurement, then this is all of the parameter space that is affected by this dynamics.
Let me ask you a question. So, the production happens, so when you say inflationary production, you assume the fluctuations of the field during the inflationary period. Now, you will produce those strings at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the question is, does it even behave like dark matter above that line?
No, it won't. So once these field, strings form, they will first remove the gauge fields, and then like I will be telling you what do they do afterwards. Okay, so you will have a string network now, right?
But the thing is that the vortex formation after CMB, does it even matter that it happens after the CMB?
So for that line, I'm just saying let's say like someone come up with a much smarter way of producing dark photon. As long as dark photon exists at the time of the CMB, all the region above like is affected by this dynamics. Right?
Sorry, say that again.
So no matter how you are producing this dark photon, imagine you can produce it like have a very nice way like we don't know of.
Yeah.
As long as it is, has to happen before the time we know that dark matter exists, this parameter space is affected by what I'm talking
about. I see what
you're saying. Yeah. So it's like some imagining like production mechanism that I don't know. Okay, so so as Mina was asking, what happens afterwards, right? I'm left with a string network. Certainly, they don't behave like dark matter. But like, what do they do? Well, the interaction that is important is the string-string interaction. Basically, they can come across each other, crossing and exchange partners and like form loops. Okay, so in the earlier universe, this basically like moves this string network towards a scaling solution, and you basically get one of these or a couple of these strings in the in your Hubble patch, so they basically disappear. In the later universe, this is more interesting, especially around like a spinning black hole. You can form all of these loops which have different sizes, and unlike the loop that you see earlier, where the center of mass momentum is equal to zero because of the symmetry, these loops which form later will all have different velocities going in different directions, so they are going to fly out everywhere. Okay, from the black hole. So they can fly out, and for some parameter space, these strings will oscillate. They will dissipate in dark photon and also in gravitational wave. And these gravitational wave signals you can look for example, with LIGO. And these strings, in some parameter space, they can be like a very, very long-lived, so they can go all the way to you on the Earth. And since you are producing so many of them in this Bosanova event, even after traveling for thousands of years, they actually come to you on Earth with with a really high abundance, potentially more than 1 per second. Okay, so I'm just showing you some preliminary plots from the studies of both of these observational signatures. So here, like I'm showing you the gravitational wave, which can come from the collapse of these string loops. Which can produce a gravitational wave with a different amplitude as a function of frequency. So this is the roughly the sensitivity of the gravitational wave detectors today. Well, this will be what we can potentially get in the future. So the one thing I want to highlight is that since the loops you produce can of different size, some of which much, much smaller than the size of the black hole, they can produce a really, really high-frequency gravitational wave with a large abundance or a large amplitude all the way to megahertz or even gigahertz. So this is maybe of interest in some of the new gravitational wave detectors we are thinking of to look for gravitational wave in the high-frequency region. Okay, so the other thing is like these strings can come all the way towards us and like interact with the accelerometers and gravitational wave detectors we have on Earth. And these will produce signals which looks like a glitch, and but with a frequency and amplitude pattern that I can predict. So these things we can look for, again, like with these accelerometers.
Is there a way to avoid the formation of this
thing? As long as you have a compact gauge group, you cannot. Like. Yeah, so the actual presence of the Higgs state is not necessary. Basically, in the superconductor, the Cooper pair is basically a pair of electrons. There's no fundamental Higgs particle, but you do need like this field, this gauge group to be a field direction which is compact. So yeah, so the take home message of this part is that. We are interested in understanding like whether the picture of a classical wave in the weak field picture, limit is always going to be a good description for these light bosons in the early universe. And then we discovered some dramatic effects in the form of string Bosanova, where like vortices emerge from this growing high amplitude wave. And this has implications for dark photon dark matter, as well as for some new signals which we can look for with Dirac detection. So these dynamics are also important in scenarios where we consider the two-stream instability in freezing dark matter for the experts, if you're interested when talking about it. And if we want to ever get actually like a robust constraint on the standard model photon mass from measurement of galaxy B field, we need to understand these vortex dynamics too, both of which are ongoing work that I'm trying to understand now. So that's all for today. So I hope I've convinced you that we should be looking for these light bosons as either a dark matter or important ingredient in the dark sector. And the novel collective dynamics, both in the case of the standard model photon, also in the dark sector medium, will be important in us designing searches for these light bosons, and also telling us maybe like where we should emphasize put our effort in to look for these particles. So with the these two examples, that's it. Thank you. Oh, so like that constraint doesn't depend on like abundance of the dark photon. Like, so it's really like the same model photon which is going to dark photon. So no matter how much you start, as long as they don't start exactly at the same amount as the photon, that constraint would apply. And we know it doesn't because of an effective measurement, right? Like we know like there's not at the same amount of radiation in dark photon as in the soft photon.
The way I'm trying to actually generate magnetic fields out of the non-zero photon mass and make it
smooth.
You're talking about generating streams, right?
So, Right. So right now, like we're really just trying to understand, like so unlike here, the challenge in here is like you also have a plasma, right? The plasma is everywhere in the universe, and the vortices is happening inside the plasma. So the question is like how to describe like this vortex line inside the plasma, and how does it actually move around like in this plasma? So in what they did, they basically assume like these vortices once they form, they are just to stay there. But like, if you just do the math, you will see like they actually move around. And right now, we are just trying to understand how they move around for the moment. But once we do, maybe we'll be able to say like, oh, whether you can start with plasma dynamics and generate these vortices and produce B field. Yeah.
Why does the dark matter
So like these constraints that I showed you earlier, they usually like come from like a dark photon converting into photon, right? So the conversion rate of dark photon into photon also depends on this kinematics in parameter epsilon. And the bigger the epsilon, of course, I see more of the light coming out, and that will be more sensitive. So right now, like that's why like the constraint will be depending on epsilon.
But if all the dark matter turns into a string network?
So this is just showing you that in this region of parameter space, which is shaded in pink, the dark photon dark matter will disappear. So they cannot be dark matter anymore.
Is it clear that that's
so you're just, if I understood it correctly, well, maybe let me ask, do you know in the cosmological dynamics, not around the black hole, but
yeah. Yeah. So
is it mostly loops, and in that case, why
shouldn't that? So like when you form, it starts with the small loops, but like this string network, as you know, like it will evolve towards a scaling solution very quickly. So like you start with like many loops, right? But then like these loops just becomes like quickly like become like one string, per Hubble patch, and that cannot be dark matter, as you know. So they can decay to gravitational wave and also like a highly relativistic dark photon.
Oh, I
yeah.
see. So they
create a cluster.
Yeah.
I
like
cluster. Is it really clear that that's the dynamics? Because I mean, they cluster, right? There are
no, like, but like this dynamics is happening, let's say, like at a ratio of you know, like 10 to the 20. It's very, very early on. The supradiance car. Huh? The point about like after the CMB is just like the amplitude of the dark photon at that point, when the universe's KeV temperature is still very high. So if the dark photon exists at that point, they are going to form loops, and these loops will dissipate the energy which is originally stored as a dark matter component. So yes, it's just gone. Like in both cases, I'm just saying, like in this parameter space, the dark photons are gone as dark matter. Yeah, they cannot be dark matter anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You make the value of this extremely large, and the
yeah.
that button is extremely small.
Yeah.
These strings will have a very large energy, right? So then how do they form?
So the string will have a large energy. Yes, the string will have a large energy, but like the background energy density you have is also very large. Yeah, so which is why like this didn't go all the way to like a zero epsilon, right?
So you're saying
epsilon
is affected by maybe.
So basically here like we are assuming that the kinetic mixing parameter is not much larger than the gauge coupling.
But
I
could
have
principle.
So you can do it with so this is something detail I didn't go into. So you can you might think like you can do it with something like a what's it called, like a clockwork mechanism. But like the clockwork mechanism comes with all the Higgses. And the Higgs, which is coupled to the U1, that is mostly, that is coupled also to this fermion, which mediates the kinetic mixing, will be the first one to produce a string. So doing that actually didn't help you.
And you're saying there's no way around.
Like without tuning. Yeah. At least we don't know anything. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.